What an interesting transition with our project, since we have no use of technology, no Facebook, no social media, and working with Amish and Mennonite communities. So we're going to have to take a little bit of a transition with this project. I want to sincerely thank Dr. Vogelzang for the introduction and acknowledge the Public Health, Education, and Health Promotion section for the opportunity to be here to talk about a very important topic in addressing chronic diseases in specific population groups. I'd like to acknowledge the individuals listed here on the screen, as well as tell you how honored I am to be here today in the presence of two of my great colleagues, Austin Check and Haley Regal, who were instrumental in the daily operation and evaluation of our program. Also honored to be here in the presence of a colleague, Dr. Allison Linton from Walden University, with whom we're both faculty members, and glad to be here as well. I'd like to also acknowledge the thousands and thousands of Amish women and Mennonite women who participated in our program in the last 18 years, whose generous offering of focus groups and sharing of data have allowed this education program to be designed. I think as we start out, one of the first questions that maybe we'd like to ask is to provide a little bit of a background about who the Amish are. Who are they? And I know if we had more time, we could do an exercise where if we ask you that someone from a different planet came here and stood in the room and said, tell me about the Amish, could you write that down for me? Typically people can write pretty quickly comments or thoughts they know about the community. But if that same stranger from a different planet said, well, tell me about your people, it's a little bit more difficult to explain, isn't it? And one of the comments I'd like to share and caveats is that even though we've had experiences working with dozens of Amish and Mennonite community members, we realize that our experiences don't reflect the entire Amish and Mennonite community, and so you may have experiences in your own states that might be somewhat different than ours. We often say we sometimes take that chance to describe communities or populations with just one overarching view, and we say there's some danger in those generalizations, and we're trying to avoid that today and provide that framework for you. I know if you want to look at the answer of who the Amish and Mennonite are, the media is definitely a place to provide a lot of information. We've seen in the last 5 years this huge uptick in reality shows from very reputable sources, right? From the National Geographic and Discovery Channel with Amish Mafia. There's even now an Amish Ghost Stories, if you've not seen that or not. So these shows really, in some ways, I felt have done more damage in depicting the community in a light that not necessarily reflects the entire Amish and Mennonite community. If we look at that, though, if the media is not a way to trust, one of the ways, of course, we in public health, we look at the literature, right? And look at what we see in terms of that. Now, granted, some of these studies are a little bit dated, I'll give you that. But if we look at the peer-reviewed research, we see that there's differences in how people view even preventive care. We learn that the Amish don't really accept preventive medicine. That's not a concept to them. We also learn that they don't practice preventive medicine due to their religio-cultural beliefs that, in fact, really this the whole concept of healthcare is something that's not understood. On the contrary, though, we see in other studies that the Amish are actively involved in health promotion. So we see differences in how people view this community. I guess when we're asked about who the Amish are, there's a wonderful little book that you can buy in many of the Amish tourist sites, especially in large Amish population groups. And there's a husband and wife team, Merle and Phyllis Good, who answered this question in their book, The 20 Most Asked Questions About the Amish and Mennonite. I think it's a great way to describe any population, where they indicate that in answering that question, that anyone who tries to answer that question in one simple sentence is either naive or purposely unkind, which of us who want our lives sums up in one sweeping statement. Yet many of us demand this of other people's lives. We'd like to just acknowledge the great diversity in Amish and Mennonite communities that exist throughout the world, and that there's certainly something to say about understanding that we really can't describe them in one particular group. Just to give you a little background, though, Amish populations exist, actually, settlements in over half the states in the U.S., and Ohio contains the world's largest and fourth largest Amish settlements, and the world's largest settlement consists of over 30,000 Amish members. Now, there's some unique barriers that exist for this population group, one of them being language, and English is the second language for most Amish communities. And what's interesting is that the primary language is a dialect of German that we here in the United States call Pennsylvania Dutch, but it is an oral language only, so we cannot even write in their main language with which they speak. It's also a dead language, so no new words are being added to this as well. So it adds to the complexity of how we communicate health education messages for this group. Also, in some communities, they are trilingual and they speak High German in some of their church services. In addition to that, some of the other barriers that exist include the fact that many communities have no telephone, so they may have to walk down a lane in order to access a phone or wait until they get into town to be able to make the phone calls needed for any of their healthcare issues. In addition to that, some Amish and some Mennonite communities rely exclusively on horse and buggy for transportation. So the way in which programs are being scheduled are dependent upon how long it takes for that horse and buggy to get into town. The other piece to this that's important to note is that my own epidemiological research about 10 years ago revealed a disproportionately higher death rate from breast cancer of Amish women living in the world's largest Amish settlement. So in collaboration with the Ohio Department of Health, we had worked with case matching over 19,000 records between the years 1996 and 2002. And what we observed is that the incidence rate from breast cancer, when comparing Amish women in the world's largest and fourth largest settlement compared to white women in those counties and state and national averages, is that the incidence rate of breast cancer was about half that, was what we observed in the other white women in state and national averages. But we attributed that to lower screening rates. What was disturbing was that if we looked at the mortality rates from breast cancer during that same time period, if we noticed that in Ohio, for example, the mortality rates for breast cancer was 28.9 per 100,000 for white women. National SEER data looked at 25.9. And for Holmes County, the world's largest settlement, the mortality rate was 43.9 per 100,000. The leading cause of death of Amish women under the age of 60 during that time period was breast cancer. So a little bit about our program. We are a multi-agency collaborative, and this is a collaboration between Ohio Health, which is one of the largest healthcare providers in the state, serves over half the counties in our 88 counties in the state. This is also a collaboration, to give you a little background. The name of our program is called Project Hoffnung, which is German for hope. And Project Hoffnung is really a community-led initiative. So we try to make the distinction. We hear a lot about community-based participatory research, but we're really talking about a community-led initiative where community members are empowered by those of us with resources and information so that they can make their own decisions. It requires a different pace and a different amount of time and effort to make sure the community is driving everything we do with this project. And Project Hoffnung was established in 1997 as a result of work I was doing with the National Cancer Institute addressing disproportionately higher cancer rates that we've seen in the Appalachian regions of the United States. In addition to that, what was established in 2011, because we relied on obviously fiscal agents to support our program, the Center for Appalachian Research and Cancer Education was established in 2011 as a nonprofit organization with a mission of reducing the burden of cancer in Appalachian rural communities by providing culturally competent healthcare and health education, by educating healthcare professionals about the distinct cultural needs of communities, and researching, planning, implementing, and evaluating effective health interventions to achieve health equity in cancer education, screening, treatment, and survivorship. And so with our program, we needed to develop a logo, a way to brand the project. I know after a year or two, Amish community members would share with us, "We don't like you calling it just Amish and Mennonite Breast Cancer Project. It makes it sound like you're not helping anybody else, and we want to know that you're helping everybody, not just us. Why just us?" So we established the project in branding our program for HOPE, Project Hoffnung. And of course, we know what the pink ribbon stands for, but the rainbow was chosen as part of our logo, really as from the biblical reference of the use of a promise. And just as God had used the rainbow to promise that he would not destroy the earth again with a flood, we chose the rainbow over the pink ribbon over the rainbow to indicate our promise of hope to Amish and Mennonite women in the fight against breast cancer. A little bit about the methodology for the program. Again, we've been in working for the last 18 years, and there have been 8 specific distinct interventions with our health education intervention. And with this, we rely a lot on developing screenings in communities in some of the most resource-starved sections of the state, utilizing mobile mammography, utilizing a nurse practitioner on site to take part in these breast cancer screening programs, in addition to having Amish and Mennonite community health workers trained to be on site to help with the program as well. And what we really are trying to address with our programs through the years is really the same question I think that all of us on the panel are addressing today. We know that we have information that can save women's lives. And the question that we have to ask and answer is that if you only have 15 minutes to spend with a woman you may never see again your entire life, what do you tell her? What are those key messages? And more important, how do you explain it? And are there some specific messaging that would be helpful in retaining the knowledge? We know in order to reduce those mortality rates, we need to be more effective in actually addressing increasing compliance to breast cancer screening. So that's what we're trying to focus on with the study. And actually with this program, it's been the questions that we reutilized were adapted from Dr. Victoria Champion's health belief model. And with this, obviously, there were 13 specific knowledge questions that we're addressing that was looking at perceived benefits and barriers to breast cancer screening compliance. With our program, what we learned in a previous study was that there was a distinct difference to make with two population groups we were looking at with our program. And those we referred to as the new participants, participants who had never been in the program before or who had not been with us in the last 2 years. And then the participants we call old, and I know it's not the best term, but we refer to them internally as our old participants who had actually been a part of our program at least within the last 2 years. Now with this then, what we had actually done is that the new participants received the entire education messaging session that lasted about 15 minutes. But for the old participants, this methodology, and what we wanted to try out, was that if we had these six key messages on these breast cancer education cards, old participants would come to the screening and everybody received education intervention prior to any of the screening services that day. And they actually went into a room and they randomly drew a card that was going to be the key messaging for that particular education intervention. The results here are too small to read, but I know that the presentation is made available online so you can dig into some of the specific frequency data that's delineating between the old and new participants per key questions, looking at both pre- and post-test answers on each of the questions asked. I guess to drill down just a little bit with the questions, one of the interesting results that we found, there were 552 participants in the study in our 2014-15 year, and you can see the mean score for pre- and post-test listed here. And obviously, old participants, at least participants who had been within our program in the last 2 years, we did see on start a higher pre- and post-test scores with our program. But what was interesting to us is that women most frequently incorrectly answered a question that involved the issue of age as a risk factor for breast cancer. So again, it was the question talking about the older you are, the higher the risk of breast cancer. Who's at more risk? Women older than 50, women younger than 50, or there's no difference in the risk of getting breast cancer. We'll talk a little bit more about that result, but we thought it was an interesting finding between both pre- and post-test groups and old and new participants. Now, in looking at some of our results, the good news is that the education did work. At least we saw a statistically significant increase in knowledge in both old and new participants utilizing these two specific education intervention programs. What was also interesting, and maybe looking at, I think for us, comparing what we're trying to look at in this particular model is graph, is looking at the positive and negative ranks and ties among differences between pre- and post-test scores. I'm going to drill in more deeply into the old and new participants. So you see the new folks on the left and the old participants on the right. And you're looking at each of the key questions that were asked in the survey. And the post-tests were disseminated 3 months after the education intervention. And what was interesting to note is that this is obviously three layers back, but those, the lime green color in the back, those are the individuals who didn't change their response between pre- and post-tests, so they maintained their same answer. The group in the middle, that's the group we like to see, those were the individuals who had incorrectly answered on the pre-test that question, but then answered correctly in post. That's the movement that we want to see. What we find interesting really is that first group, and those are the individuals who had gotten the answer right pre and then incorrectly answered the response for post. And so that's where we're trying to drill in with some of our studies. With this particular result, one interesting note to make is that in looking at, again, the question about risk factor associated with breast cancer, and it's the one that you see that's the second question from the left that's called WHO cancer, you'll notice again in the first chart there were a number of individuals who, again, had correctly answered in pre and then incorrectly answered in post. And we noticed that behavior, again, as we said, in both pre and post tests. Well, one of the other factors we want to look at is that obviously we want to know, since this is a longitudinal study over 18 years, that any previous participation in the study increased knowledge. And we did know that there was a significant effect of number of years participating in the program. So the longer that an individual had participated with us in the education interventions year after year, the higher their knowledge scores were. And there was a more significant impact at pre-test on that particular piece. That was good for us to know that there was some retention of the knowledge that we shared year after year. Unlike in other years we've done this study, in particular in 2014-15, it was noted that age really was not a factor. Typically we'd seen that the older an individual was, typically knowledge scores were higher at younger ages, but this was not the case in this particular study. One of the other pieces that we noticed is that we're going back to our original question is, what about the cards? Did they make an impact? And again, the question that we're trying to ask is that, is there some way in looking at any key messages that might actually increase that retention of knowledge at post-test by some of the messages that we had? And what we found is that overall, we really didn't see a significant effect on which card was delivered with the total education knowledge at the post-test. It is interesting to note, though, that there was a very, very weak significant relationship between individuals who had randomly selected the clinical breast exam card and received that messaging, ironically, and those individuals did receive a slightly higher increase in knowledge at post-test. But again, it was a very, very weak effect. What we noticed, though, again, looking at the clinical breast exam, is that if we saw those individuals who had correctly answered in pre and incorrectly answered in post, most of those individuals that had shifted in incorrectly answering came from our old group, came from the group that had previously participated. Let me share in closing a few of our conclusions. We did note that obviously using a targeted education intervention to both new and past participants in our program did show to statistically increase knowledge. What we did note, though, is that for old participants, we felt like we've met that threshold, that we really could not move individuals to receiving all seven questions correct, that it was very difficult to move individuals to those highest levels of education attainment. And then we also noticed, too, as we said, a very weak significant effect of those individuals who had randomly received the clinical breast exam card in increasing knowledge at post-test level. We also noticed, too, a retention effect of individuals who had been more repeat participants in the program did have higher knowledge levels, which was good to know. And that we noticed as well that there are additional opportunities for targeted educational messaging that we can continue to do outside the screenings that might have an impact in increasing knowledge on some of these key messaging that we have in breast cancer facts. And a couple limitations of the study as I close. I think you will note that this is really incredible that our post-test rate, obviously response rate, is almost 54% for this study, which is wonderful, but we do recognize that there might be some limitations in the individuals who submitted the post-test, those who did not. Again, this is a challenging group in a sense to look at other factors that might be impacting knowledge. It's a very homogenous group. Pretty much everyone was married, white, same education level. So looking at other demographic factors that might be impacting this particular population group, it's a little more challenging to be able to see what those issues are. And that is it. I feel happy to answer any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to present today.